Hello and welcome to Coffee with Conservationists. After several months away, I'm back with a podcast where I sit down with people who dedicate their lives to researching, protecting, and documenting nature. I talk to them about issues affecting wildlife, the climate, and global biodiversity. We cover diverse topics within ecology, biology, storytelling, activism, and much more. My coffee feature today is counterculture coffee. I'll tell you a bit more at the end of the episode. Today, I talk with master student, scientist, and your friendly neighbourhood moth trapper, Madeline Fabasova. We talk about the issues affecting moths, their importance to their surrounding environment, and breaking down the strange stigma surrounding these beautiful creatures. Hi, Madeline. I'm going to be a little rusty because I have not recorded a podcast episode since August last year. But we're going to give it a go and see what happens. So we're going to start off by asking you the same question that I ask everyone, which is, where did you get your start in wildlife conservation and nature and everything to do? You know, why are you here, basically?
So I've always grew up in a very remote place that had a lot of nature around it. So I kind of was always drawn to it. And both of my parents work in agriculture. So from that perspective, I've always been involved with nature. And then when I was deciding what to do at uni after A-levels, I knew I wanted to go into biology, but I never wanted to do straight biology because of the human side of it that I'm not so interested in. And then when I came across the course that I do, conservation biology and ecology, I was like, that is perfect. And I went into it. And then basically everything I do now, I got into at uni through involvement in student societies and chatting with very cool people and just my friends and the things they do.
Yeah, amazing. We're here to talk about moths, which is very cool. Most people don't like moths. Yeah. A lot of people don't like moths. I know my mum is really scared of them. She can't explain why. She just doesn't like them. Why do you like them so much? Why are you the opposite?
Well, I think they're very important for the ecosystem. So for anyone who doesn't know, they're very important pollinators. And they belong in the same group as butterflies. So a lot of people associate butterflies as being the pretty ones around and then moths as being the ugly ones that eat your clothes, which is a very common myth. It's not true. And there's only 5 species of moths in the whole of UK that eat clothes, 3 of which are only very common. And that's because of the change in the production of clothing and what materials they're made from. So I think, yeah, moths are very important for the ecosystem. And equally, I think they're very accessible species to study as they come to light. So you can very easily look at them. And there's such a huge diversity in them that I wouldn't want to study anything else because you learn something new every day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's entirely fair enough. We're out here, well, you're about to go and do some field work, which is very cool. And we're on Trimmo campus, which is a really biodiverse campus, generally. You mentioned they're an important pollinator, really important for the ecosystem around them. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? How?
Moths, and the same as butterflies, there's actually no distinction between moths and butterflies, for anyone wondering. Someone just decided back in the day to call the pretty ones butterflies and the other ones moths. But yeah, so they're mostly nocturnal, so about 75% to 85% of all moths are nocturnal, which means that they fly at night or that they're active at night. But there are also some day-flying ones that are called diurnal. And moths play multiple roles in the ecosystem because when they're adults, they're very important pollinators, so their nectar and flowers and such spread pollen, the same as bees do or any other insects. But equally, as larvae, they feed on many different plants, which is also how you can find them. So if you look at leaves that have little trails on them, you're most likely to find moths. But they're also therefore important food for a lot of birds and a lot of other insect-consuming organisms. And this serves as a very important indicator of the how well the ecosystem is functioning. Because if you have a large diversity of moths, it means you likely have a large diversity of plants because they depend on the plants in the life stages. And such, it kind of shows you that you've got a very important, a very biodiverse place. And equally, a lot of moths are considered as pests because they eat plants that humans consume. However, that's just part of their lifestyle. And from that perspective, they also control some other insects that are found on the plants.
Amazing. I don't think a lot of people listening would have... Well, a lot of non-kind of moth fans listening would know all of this, because, as you said, the common misconceptions are much more prevalent in our society than the reality around moths.
Yes, definitely. But I think it's changing. I think conservation is doing a lot to highlight the roles of other insects other than bees and butterflies that are present, which is very important.
Yes, yeah. There's definitely... I grew up in the world where insects were like celebrated in natural history content generally, but they like a lot less so than, you know, other groups. Reading kids' magazines geared at wildlife and conservation, you would learn about pandas and, you know, the big species and lions and the things that are
flagship species.
Yeah, obviously they're under threat as well, but, you know, everything's relative there. They get a lot more media attention.
Definitely.
But now with a lot, there's a lot of bigger charities, butterfly conservation being one of them, who do a lot of work with moths, I think, which I think they should be the butterfly and, well, the moth and butterfly conservation.
I think that kind of highlights group.
But that kind of highlights what we're talking about, doesn't
exactly.
it? How they don't include that in the name, because it might potentially put people off. Why do you love field work so much? I think the first time I heard you were into moths was meeting you, like bumping into you on the way back from like a just after sunrise walk. Like, it was like 6 a.m.
Yeah.
You're walking back through some fields outside Swampool.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're like, oh, I've just been checking some moth traps since like 2 hours ago. Field work is, for anyone who's done it, there's a lot of my listeners are scientists, it's not easy, and it's not necessarily fun.
There's
but,
a lot of things that go wrong. But,
yeah, but it always seems to put a smile on your face whenever I hear you talking about it.
Yeah, no, I think it's very rewarding, because I personally learn the best if I see things. So the only way I've learned how to ID all the different moths is by simply looking at them. And then when I was deciding to do some more serious research, I knew I couldn't be stuck inside, because I wouldn't be able to do it, wouldn't be able to motivate myself for it. And also, I think there's a lot of lot more wildlife and stuff that we can learn directly, you know, through simple exercises in field. So that's how I got into field work, I suppose. But also, I just love being outside, so it's pretty cool that I can combine those two and say I'm doing research when, you know, I'm just walking around looking at moths, really, realistically.
Yeah. Yeah, any excuse to go outside is a good excuse. What's your least favourite thing about it? Do you have one?
Well, I wouldn't say it's least favourite. It's always difficult when, you know, things don't work the way you expected them. So I think every methodology that's ever, you know, belonged in field work has failed before it even started. And you have to, like, you know, try things 10 times before you even get to the start of it. But I think that's kind of rewarding, because you learn from it. It's frustrating at times, especially if you do nocturnal field work like I do. And you have to stay up late and then get up early again the next day, again to look at moths. But I think it's, you know, I wouldn't know everything that I do know if things didn't go wrong. So I wouldn't say it's my least favourite, but it's quite frustrating at times.
I can imagine it's... Yeah, I can't. I'm not a scientist, as you know, but I can. Getting up ridiculously early to catch a particular image as a photographer and storyteller. You know, I've walked up to Loveland recently for a sunrise image that I knew I wanted, and just missed the perfect rise by about like 2 minutes. I just didn't get up just that early enough. So it is always frustrating.
There have been times I got here, did all my things, did all my preparation, then realised I forgot my net. The most important part of my field work, and then just had to call it a day.
It's very demoralising, demotivating, but you obviously pick yourself up very quickly.
I think it's just, you just have to remember you have another day that you can do it. And if you miss the perfect weather, then, well, I guess another day will come, so.
Yeah. We're mostly here to talk about your research and, you know, why it's important generally. What are the main issues affecting moths? Because they're not a flagship species, most people won't know that they're actually in trouble, like most nature is. But, you know, what are the main things that really cause them harm?
Well, I think because moths have so many different stages, they are likely to be affected more widespread than some species that are not so like niche specific or reliant on specific plants. So I think the biggest change that we know of affecting moths is habitat change. So any kind of degradation of habitat, destruction of habitat, removal of habitats and everything like that. And obviously climate change, as the physiological processes in moths are changing with climate change. But I think, as everyone, if you know one thing about moths, you definitely know that they're attracted by light, which is very interesting. And no one actually knows why they do it. There's many different theories for it, but no one has concretely established as to why that is. But it does therefore raise the question of how artificial light is likely to impact moths. And so with increasing urbanisation and introduction of artificial light environments, we have noticed that there are large declines in moths. So like between 1970 and 2016, there has been a 34% decline in the 400 most common macromoths, so the big ones, which is quite alarming to hear. And equally, like in Europe, there is 88% of countries have high levels of light pollution. And therefore, I think it's important that we address what are the impacts of light on moths, not just from the perspective of trapping them and looking at them, but also more in the landscape, because the light is always present there. And, you know, street lamps provide security for people, headlights of cars are needed so that we get home safely and things like that, which is obviously very important. But I think we need to look at that trade-off between the two and see, you know, what effect does it have on the insects as well as on people.
Yeah, of course. With, obviously, we're not in a city. We're in quite a small town, relatively. We obviously do have still a lot of light pollution. Is there a way to accurately gauge how much light pollution from a city would affect a moth if you're doing research just in a rural town?
Yeah, so I think you can scale up what we do here at the Trimmer Campus to a much wider scale, because, you know, moths, the reason they're affected by light is because they're attracted to particular frequencies of light. They're different to human vision, and such, they'll be similar across the scale regardless of where you are. Obviously, the more of light pollution there is, the more likely it's to be detrimental. But I think we shouldn't get, you know, held up on the fact that we are actually in a very biodiverse place, because I think we should celebrate that, and actually that allows us to do the research before it's too late. So I think you can definitely scale up small scale research into, you know, assessing bigger impacts. But I think what is more important to acknowledge is that in bigger cities, you're probably less likely to have green spaces for the moths.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the effect of the light might not actually be the same as they would be down here. And that is not because of the light, that is simply because the place is less biodiverse. So I think there is a trade-off between the two. But I think we are very lucky to live here, and we have such great diversity of moths and other insects and birds and everything else, that we can celebrate that and also study it quite extensively.
Yeah, amazing. Are we pressed on time?
No, not at all.
All good. Just checking, because you do have to get to your field work.
Yeah.
Which will try and be a part of the podcast, but also we don't want to get in your way too much. With, you mentioned, obviously, talked a lot about biodiversity and environment of the local area. Is there a specific habitat that a large proportion of moths like or enjoy, or are they fairly widespread throughout?
I would say they're fairly widespread throughout. So basically anything that grows will have something feeding on it. It's kind of the simple rule of thumb. I think lot of trees, so a lot of caterpillars are on trees. So if you want to ever find caterpillars on all larvae and moths, go look at trees. But I think also grasses. So whilst moths are very niche specific, so it means that they rely on a very specific habitat for their life cycle. As a species group overall, I think they're very widespread. So it's probably worth looking everywhere for moths and seeing where we can find them and what species you can find them.
If we imagine for a second that there's someone who's listened to this episode and they do not have any form of academic background and they hated moths their entire life, and they listen to this and go, oh wow, they're actually really cool, I want to learn more and I want to help their conservation. Obviously they're not going to be contributing to concrete research, but how can they get involved?
Well, I think the best way and the easiest way to get involved is just look what's around. So maybe next time you see a moth in your bedroom or somewhere else, take a picture of it and try to identify it, because I think there's a lot of resources on the internet, in public libraries, and there's a lot of societies. Also interesting, the Facebook groups and Twitter groups that will help you ID them. So it's nothing to get intimidated by, but obviously it's fun to get started with yourself. And I think once you get excited about something, then you can help it more. And volunteering for a lot of charities, such as Butterfly Conservation, that deliver practical fieldwork that aims to restore habitats is always useful. But I appreciate that not everyone has the time to, you know, go out every Saturday for 3 hours and dig up some soil. So I think maybe raising awareness and telling your friends that moths are actually really important and maybe you shouldn't kill them is important. Or if you have the financial capabilities, supporting charities that deliver work is always great. But I think on a small scale, if you're lucky enough to have a garden, planting a lot of variety of plants, I'm sure will be appreciated by a whole section of wildlife, including moths.
Yeah, amazing. We're going to get to some slightly more easy, fun questions in a little bit, but you have a big sheet. You came prepared. I came less prepared, which shows my professionalism. Although I was drinking coffee at like 6:30 in the morning when I wrote these questions, so I was embodying a scientist, so it's fine. But definitely less professional. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you specifically feel the need to mention or would like to mention?
I think just a couple of things. One, that I think someone who maybe isn't so involved with conservation as we are might think that it'll be very hard to support such a small species or species group, and that I can't actually do anything about it. But I think that's could be very demoralising, but I think everyone can help. And whilst mitigation strategies have to be very specific for each species, there's not to say that you can't do anything. So, you know, as I've already said, like supporting anyone you can or just looking at the interesting things yourself is important and will allow you to, you know, engage more with nature, which is obviously good for yourself, but also I think expose you to a wider part of the biodiversity that you might have not come across before. And you might be thinking, well, you know, moths, like, why should I just support them? Like, I should probably support the whole habitat. And I agree. I think we should definitely do conservation. That's landscape level, not just species level. But I think, you know, if you start a species, then you can kind of build up from that. Or, like, you know, that single organism. And it also might be, you know, more accessible or easier, quicker. All those things, and also because of how concrete part of the ecosystems moths are, you know, supporting them will inherently support everything else. And I think the other thing that I wanted to mention is, I think in the recent years, as artificial light has been increasing, research into artificial light has been increasing, which is great, and promotes that work is being done. But I think equally hand in hand, citizen science has been increasing a lot. So a lot of people go into moth trapping during COVID, or during the first, second, third, fourth lockdown,
mm.
Including myself. So yeah, I started when I was my first year, which would have been September 2020, so just after the first major lockdown. That's when I started looking at moths.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, people had a lot of time and they wanted to spend it doing something. Therefore, a lot of people started recording things. And the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology and UK Moths, which are... UK Moths is like a big, wide recording scheme for moths, combined efforts and they created a website. It's called What's Flying Tonight, where you can look to see what moths are likely to be seen in your area. So if you want to, you know, get a head start on... IDing moths, then you can go in there and look, have a clue, or even if you're just interested to see what's around, or you know how many pretty colours there are that day, you can go on the website. So that's just something I want to highlight, because it's a lot of us are very lucky to have access to the internet, so I think we should use it and learn some cool things.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I think definitely a lot of people started. I saw so many people suddenly moth trapping. It was a really accessible thing. You could get all the knowledge and most of the equipment fairly like cheaply, or make it yourself at home. Yeah, there was just one of the many amazing citizen science projects that got us all through a really tough time.
Exactly.
Me and you were very lucky because Trimmo campus was classed as our garden legally throughout the whole. So we have this like massive estate to roam around, as if we were living in student halls in first year. So I feel very privileged to have been, you know, don't think I'd survive the lockdown, but I just about got through it with the help of this such an amazing biodiverse area, which I'm sad to lose soon. lose access to, not... It's not getting destroyed, don't worry. It's still going to be here. I won't be here as often, sadly. But yeah, tricky one for you. What's your favourite moth?
That is a very tricky question. I think it changes like every day, because every day I find a moth that I've never seen before, and it's very exciting. Like just this morning, long time ago now, what it feels like, I saw a new moth called the wax moth that I've never seen before. They're not actually very common, but so it just never happens to be in the trap. Can't say it's my favourite yet, because I've only seen it once, so I might not see it again, and therefore I can't class it as my favourite, because I won't get excited about it often. But I think rather than having a favourite moth, the favourite thing I have about moths themselves is just how beautiful they are, and how many different colours there are in moths. So you might think they're all brown, but actually there's a lot of green ones, a lot of yellow ones, a lot of pink ones, purple ones, and all so many different colours and everything, which all kind of either serve as a camouflage mechanism or as a predator deterrence mechanism, which is very cool and interesting. So I think it's my important thing, my favourite thing to like learn, you know, what could this moth be trying to imitate, or what is it trying to look at? And then yeah, there's so many different patterns on them and stuff like that that I think you can constantly keep learning. So I don't think I have a favourite moth per se. I have the ones I always get excited one by, like a buff tips. They look like just like a stick. Like if you found a stick on the floor and a buff tip, it'll probably look the same. But basically the hawk moths, the big ones that you always see on pictures. They're kind of the flagships of moth conservation, and they're the pink ones and all the big ones. But I equally get excited by the really, really tiny ones. And it's only been recently, through interacting with some actually new moth trappers to campus, that I've been learning how you ID them. Because it's quite intimidating when you have something less than the size of your thumbnail to look and be like, okay, what is this and how do I distinguish it from other things? But I learned how you ID a new one today, because it had four very distinct stripes. And I think if you don't look close enough, you might not appreciate that as much. So I think I don't think I have one favourite moth, because I think that would be really hard. But there's a lot of ones that I really like seeing. And yeah, every time I see a new one, I'm like, wow, this is so cool. Or every spring, I start moth trapping again, because obviously they're not that active at winter. And I'm like, wow, I haven't seen you in like a year. And it's very exciting. It's like seeing an old friend.
That's a really really beautiful answer. I think a lot of people just kind of get stumped because I used to ask like a rapid fire questions at the end of my podcast. I stopped doing that for a variety of reasons, but whenever I asked what someone's favourite animal was, they'd go, I don't know, I don't have one. And then they'd like think of something on the spot that probably wasn't their favourite one, but is something they, you know, they think they had to say. So the fact that you're very confident in the fact you don't have a favourite moth and you turned it into something really nice is very, very cool. So thank you. The last question has nothing to do with moths. I really hope it has nothing to do with moths, because otherwise somebody is breaking several major ethical boundaries. But how do you like your coffee?
How do I like my coffee? Served as quickly and accessible as possible. Actually, does have a lot to do with moths, because if it wasn't for coffee, I don't think I would ever make it to the 6 a.m. moth choppings
after going to
bed at 1 a.m. So I think, yeah, I like coffee. I can enjoy the taste when, you know, enjoying it with friends and things like that. But equally, it's a beverage that keeps me going and doing field work.
I think a better question to ask then, because obviously a lot of scientists I've spoken to have just said hot, caffeinated, instant, however quickly I can get it. When you're not doing field work, when you're sitting down in a cafe with a couple of hours free time, which I know is very, very rare for you, what do you like then?
I can appreciate a black coffee if I'm sitting there for a while, because it stays hot for a while. But if I'm feeling fancy, then like a latte with some nice artwork and oat milk or soy milk is always appreciated. And I'm embarrassed to train myself, so I can appreciate how hard it is to make the patterns yourself. And I always get excited to when someone makes me a nice coffee. It kind of makes my day when there's a little heart or a flower on it. But yeah, I don't think I have a specific brand of coffee that I'm so, like, you know, interested in. But I think there's many delicious coffees around. But if I was to pick one that was the best, I was lucky enough to go to Costa Rica for a field course in my last year of uni, just a few months ago. And there, one morning we served a coffee and we were all like, wow, this is so amazing. And they were like, yeah, it's literally growing outside your window there. And it was like, wow, they've grown a coffee there and then served us that. Something about it was so special. Because there was basically no carbon footprint, because it was just like 5 minutes away. So I think that was my favourite brand of coffee.
Amazing. Do you remember what it was called?
I do not remember what it was exactly called, but it was in Monteverde in Costa Rica, if anyone is interested, at a biological research station.
Yeah, I'm going to probably feature a different coffee, because I have actually featured that coffee already, I think. I'll double check, but I think one of my previous filmmaker guests made a film at the site, so
incredible.
Yeah, but I will double check, but the name rings a really strong bell.
Any coffee is very good.
I'm gonna double check on my little notebook. When I kind of restarted the podcast after a big break, I was just like, I wrote down everything that I'd done, like every guest I'd had, because I've done maybe 39 episodes now.
Crazy.
So it's hard to be here now. Do you say Monteverde?
Yes.
Cool. Yeah, Café de Monteverde.
That is quite likely, yeah.
There we go. Cool.
Well, it's wonderful coffee, so I'm glad you featured it.
I'm going to let you talk about it again, because you did, and that's great, but I'm also going to, feature another, a different coffee to add a bit more variety. I'll choose it later and drink it in the morning, otherwise I won't get to bed. So this is a kind of walking podcast episode. This is episode 2, officially, that I've done this style of, like, you know, walking and talking about conservation and featuring a cafe or a local cafe or a podcast coffee on the podcast, and we are going to do some walking at some point, but obviously you can't do your mothing until the conditions are right, so we're gonna end the episode here briefly, and then a little bit of time for us, but a very, very, very small amount of time for people listening, we'll go and talk about some more moths in situ. So that's very cool. So thank you very much.
Nice.
Cool. So we've done a little bit of field work. I've just sat here and drank some water and not done anything useful. You set up your first moth trap. What did you do? What does it involve? Obviously, this is a podcast, so people don't know what it looks like.
Yeah, so I'll try and describe it. So actually, this is not for my research per se. This is for my hobby. I do moth trapping for fun to kind of see what we get in the traps. So a moth trap is essentially just a box with usually egg cartons inside it, so that moths have something to lie on, a lot of crevices to go into, and then a funnel on top of the box, and then a light above the funnel. And as the moths get attracted to the light, they go down, they get funneled into the box, and then they spend the night there, and they rest on the egg boxes. So it's really nothing fancy, but it does the job of attracting the moths, not harming them, because the lights don't get hot enough to kill them or anything like that. And then when we come in the morning, we'll turn off the lights because they're very bright. Not probably very good for you to look straight into them, as we are doing right now. And then you turn off the lights, you open it, and you go egg box by egg box, and you see what's resting on the egg box. And then once you've done it, and once you've recorded everything, we release the moths, we just place them in bushes around the area they've been found in, and then they go and camouflage for the day, because they become very active as they start warming up their wings, and then they find a nice sheltered shady spot and rest up for the day if we're coming back out again in the evening. We've got a couple more moth traps to set.
Nice.
It's all basically the same principle. There are some that are powered by like mains power electricity, some by battery, depending on what kind of one you're looking for, but that's just very technical and no one needs to know.
Cool. Well, yeah, let's go set up the next one. We set up moth traps, we've done all that. That's more just for what you love doing. I'm going to leave you because you're about to do very important field work and I don't want to get in the way, but what are you about to do, basically?
So for my master's project, I am looking at the impacts of pulsed light, trying to simulate headlights of cars and the impacts they might have on moths. So I go out and I follow different areas of campus. And I net moths, so I use a net to catch moths, under red light, try not influence their natural behaviour. And then I test them against four different light treatments, kind of see what behaviourally they do. And it's really exciting because I get to look at moths all evening.
Fun. Is there any major ethical issues around it?
No, so and the official ethical guidelines, no insects count under ethics, because no one believes that they have any feelings or anything like that. So from that perspective, no. But the reason I chose netting against moth trapping is just purely for the research aspect of this. I'm hypothesizing that if they were already exposed to light previously, their behavior might change. Therefore, I net them when they're flying around. So I'm not sure that will hold true once I've done my analysis, but that is the assumption for now. But I don't think there are any particular ethical issues or anything like that.
Okay, cool.
And they don't get harmed in the process. They get released straight away. So
yeah, so it's just an important part of scientific research, much like bird ringing, which a lot of outsiders can see as really crazy when you just catch birds in nets and put them through all this stress, but it's actually a really quick and easy and stress-free process.
Exactly, and there's a lot of background research that goes into assessing the methods you do to ensure that no one gets harmed in the process.
Amazing. Well, this is a great actual, like, even though it's the second time we've done this, it's a great first official walking podcast episode. Someone's breaking up a pallet over there, I think. Or just ollieing? Yeah, just skating. This is a great first walking podcast episode because we've actually done a lot of walking, which is very fun, which is what you can hear in the background, just interfering with everything, as walking does. But thank you so much. This has been really fun.
And
I hope you have a successful rest of the night, Morphing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Madeline for taking the time to speak to me today. You can find links to her social media below. My featured coffee today is from Counterculture Coffee. This roaster pays their farmers more through direct trade, long-term relationships, and supports environmental stewardship programs. They also support coffee research and donate money to seed research funds. On top of all this, they're B Corporation certified, which means they're assessed by an independent third party, B Corp, and fit their criteria for the highest levels of ethics, traceability, accountability and sustainability. The link to their website will be, as ever, in the description. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope I was quick to get back on the game after many months away. As ever, I've been your host, George Stephen Jones, and this is Coffee with Conservationists.